So we are officially 62.5% done with our 2 days. The rest of the morning, Derek's going to go through best practices for greenhouse seedling, starting, and transplant preparation. Going to go into planting and transplanting in some detail outside in the garden. I certainly have some things to offer on that too. And then I'm going to talk about some basic plant management in season, specifically refractometer and conductivity metrics, and then hopefully we'll have at least half an hour, 45 minutes, if not an hour, to do question and answer for the rest of the morning. And then this afternoon, the three of us are going to be sort of doing a pseudo panel on, we'll start off with, okay, you're a carrot or a beet or a potato or a turnip, you're a root crop. What are the critical things to do in preparing the soil, in timing, in fertility, to cover all of those critical points of influence, so that we make sure that those types of crops are getting what they need when they need it. And then we'll do fruiting crops, and then we'll do leaf crops, and then we'll do perennial crops. Trying to give you guys as many opportunities to get as much specific detail as possible on how to do these different families. We aren't going to have a chance to do broccoli versus kale, but we can do leafing crops and fruiting crops. Leave the end of the day, probably the last section or part of the last section. Really, I'd like to leave it as much open as possible for specific addressing of details, suggestions, critiques, struggles, etc. We definitely have those papers over there where you can write up questions. The three of us are going to be sitting down at lunch and reviewing everything and organizing it and making sure we get what you want addressed. So that's the basic schedule for the rest of the day. Yes?
I'd like to make a suggestion that when someone
asks a question,
asks a comment,
repeat it
because it's impossible.
Like John was doing?
Yeah.
Derek's good at that too. Yeah. All right. I'll try to do better. Sorry. I always feel free to, give me a hard time. Okay?
Yeah.
Good? All right.
So before we get started, I just want to do a couple of housekeeping things that are related, which is thinking about these learning opportunities. And over the years, I think NOFA has done a terrific job, the BFA as well, with offering opportunities. So there's flyers on the NOFA table, the Winter Greens workshop series, and that's going on. Basically, the first one is next Thursday at Natick Community Organic Farms. I think Dan's doing a course, I'm doing one. There's a lot of other good growers in the room that are doing courses. So if you're interested in learning a little bit more on the practical side of things of winter growing, those are things to keep on your schedule as well. And they also have an organic animal husbandry workshop series. So great opportunities to get out of a church sanctuary and actually learn on farms. And show and tell to start. I didn't bring the full library, but about a few books in. We're doing a winter study on the farm this year, and we've been doing that for about, I guess this is our fifth or sixth year. We normally pick something that's a little bit hard and awkward to digest, kind of like biological transmutations or some of those fringe type books. This year we went the opposite direction and took one of the more easily digestible books. It's a new book that Steve Solomon just published called The Intelligent Gardener, and it's highly recommended for anybody, especially if they're small scale producers. It does a nice job of starting to introduce a lot of these concepts. And if you look in your reader, it should be on page, I think it's 38. Just make sure we're counting pages correctly. You'll see a set of worksheets, and that's directly from Solomon's book. And basically, those worksheets, there's an online calculator now that Erica Reinheimer has put online, which will give you kind of recommendations based on a Logan Lab soil analysis. That's a subscription service for that, but these are the worksheets for that. So I just wanted to point those out as a resource, kind of a follow-up to yesterday's conversation on soil testing. So So we're going to talk today, this morning, we're going to talk a little bit about actually getting seeds going in the greenhouse, and I'm going to try to put this in a conversation that's really, again, a little bit more geared towards the commercial growers in the room, but certainly lots of practical tips for the home-scale producers. And I labeled this section of our talk the Patterns for Healthy Growth, and one of the really important elements that I think of when we're going to be working with seed starting is what are we going to be doing to create a growth pattern that's going to set that plant up for success. And so, you know, the classic example of this, and if we want to kind of pick on the home gardeners, is the folks that start their seedlings in a poorly lit part of their house, and sometimes it might be overly hot because it's a certain type of the house, a southern exposure, and by the time they take that transplant out in April, you have this really long, leggy, stocky seedling, and at that point, you've sort of created a pattern for disease or a pattern for a troubled life. And so what we're going to talk about today is what are we going to be focusing on to create that pattern for healthy growth. And John and Dana both spoke a little bit with the nutrition within the seed, the germinating environment, talking about balanced nutrition. And one thing that comes to mind is the seeds are really, they already have kind of, if you want to think of an actually good, strong, quality seed, it's going to have a lot of the nutrition it needs for that germination point. So we don't necessarily need to have, you know, tons and tons of, you know, quantity of nutrition right there at the present time of germination. But we may decide that because those seeds are not of the quality we'd like them to be, we need to actually provide a little bit of a jump or a little bit of a start. So for us, this is the reason why when we were talking about fertility budgets yesterday, the why we put our potting soil in our fertility budget. It allows us to say that, you know, this is a really important part, especially if you're growing transplants. So on our farm, we crop about 4 acres, probably somewhere in the ballpark of 800 to 1,000 flats a year, primarily because we don't have a lot of great weed control, so we do a lot of transplanting. We also have a wet field, so in the springtime it's easier to get started, and then we're trying to hit a market where we're bringing crops to a farm stand by the end of May or early May and starting our CSA. And the way we start our CSA is a little bit different than some CSAs. We start our distributions probably the second week in June, and my goal is to have those first 2-3 distributions just be absolutely abundant with crops. And I top, you know, I normally put the little line in there that says, you know, normally early season harvests are going to be lighter than they are in August because you haven't hit that, you know, abundance of tomatoes and eggplants and peppers. But I often think of that first pickup, especially for new CSA members, is this is that opportunity for us to create the halo effect for the farm. If we can have an opportunity where the first time they come away from the farm just being blown away with what they have, that gives us good graces going forward through the season. And normally we don't need to draw upon those good graces, but if we do, we have that to fall back on. So for us, what that means is we might use some transplanting of crops like beets that a lot of growers will direct seed. We'll transplant beets so that in a good year we'll have beets ready to harvest, good quality beets by the second week of June. So, you know, depending on what quantity of transplanting you're doing on the farm, for us, 4 acres, double cropping a lot of that, we end up, like I say, doing about 800 to 1,000 flats a year. So the potting soil can be a significant investment, and a lot of growers might think it's a good place to cheap out, you know, start buying a lower quality soil mix. And I would encourage you to do a couple things. Just certainly the nice thing about potting soils is there's a lot of them widely available and you can run tests going side by side and just give a sense of which grows better and what does better for you. What do we use? So I've had the pleasure of working with probably 4 potting soils over the last dozen years or so. We've used Vermont compost, we've used Ideal, we've used Living Acres up in Maine. When I was at New York and at Hawthorne Valley, we used Living Acres because they were a little bit more stringent with rules around blood and various other things that were important for biodynamics. Since we moved back to Dartmouth, we've pretty much exclusively used Vermont compost. But partially that's also based on ease of bringing pallets in, and you know, I think Mike, I don't know, are you guys shipping pallets of bagged fertilizers nowadays? I know you're doing bulk deliveries at one point, but So I think, you know, basically both of those, Ideal and Vermont Compost, I've seen a lot of them growing starts on the different farms in our area, and I think both of them are great quality products. I've also mixed, gone Elliott Coleman style, mixing your own potting soil. Did that probably about 9 or 10 years ago, and it was effective for growing good quality starts. It was not effective to grow a low-priced seedling because the labor cost in that mixing just, you know, the way I say it is kind of like soil blocks. It's like, you know, I like the idea of getting away from plastic on the farm, but for me to be able to, you know, do soil blocking on a commercial scale, I probably have to sell my lettuce at $4 a head instead of, you know, $3.50 or $3 a head. We sell it for $3 a head, 2 for $5 on the farm. And that labor cost when you're doing soil blocks, I just haven't figured out a way to afford that labor cost. And a lot of times when we think about labor, this is a little bit of a segue, but it's not always the question about how much labor in total it is, it's how much labor at that critical point of time that you also need that labor in other places. And so that's, I mean, it's not that soil blocking necessarily is all that much work, it's just we happen to be doing a lot of things in the springtime that it's in competition for. So. Yeah, we've been using Vermont compost, and we actually spike it with some other things, which we might get a chance to talk about a little bit later. So here are the things that we look for when we're starting to talk about growing quality seedlings, and this is from my personal experience and sort of a, you know, every year we're learning new things, and every year we're trying new things. We function a little bit differently on our farm, a little bit crazy in a sense that we don't use any heat except for some heat mats in our propagation house, and that's partially because we're right on the coast in southeastern Massachusetts, and so, you know, we often will get, you know, a last serious frost sometime might be the end of March. We might get frost through April, but a lot of times we can keep tomatoes with a, you know, nice piece of row cover on them in a greenhouse in April and not have concerns. So we have a little bit of flexibility, and not something that I would recommend doing. But last year, one of the things that we were doing a lot more of is running hot water out of our basement. We're on town water for because we're on leased land, but we were running hot water out of our basement so that we were starting our seedlings and making sure we were watering those seedlings in with a temperature that was appropriate for the biology of that soil mix to actually be active. And it was pretty interesting because, so we started doing this, we had done it, you know, sometimes in February in the past. We started doing this last year a little bit more aggressively, and we were having what we think were sort of our best looking seedlings we've ever grown. We're also happening to be putting in some humicarb, but basically a fixed carbon to help deal with the fact that we're using town water. And our seedlings were coming along in March, were absolutely terrific, and sometime in early April we started switching our hose up and we went off of that warm water situation. And, you know, so over the course of about 2 or 3 weeks, and Steve, who was working with me, was sort of like, you know, these seedlings aren't really popping the way they were popping before. And so we decided, you know, hey, maybe it has to do with the fact that we've turned the water back. So we flipped our water back into the basement. This is, of course, anecdotal, but sure enough, it again started to make sure that those plants were in a healthier state. And for me, this is actually even more important if you're working with one of these sort of potting soils that's compost-based and is really biology-driven, because, you know, if you're putting on water that's in the 40s or 50s, especially in a cool environment in the springtime, you're basically kind of trying to shut down a lot of the biology that wants to be making nutrients available. So when we say temperature, if you see the temperature there for seed starting, for us that's water temperature and ambient air temperature. What temperature do you think is ideal? I think it depends a little bit on what you have access to, and I hadn't gone into Schauberger's look and thinking about that. We would put it on a little bit on the warm side, but that's partially because we weren't heating our greenhouse, and it wasn't a huge cost because our water heaters run through our furnace, so in the springtime if it's running a little bit, it stays pretty warm. So it was, you know, lukewarm to touch. I don't know if other people would like to answer that, Carl.
Because of that, below. So up here where your nose is, you're playing with the thermostat,
So as we're talking about this with water temperature, obviously different crops are going to have that different response. We weren't necessarily, you know, if we were growing tomatoes and onions, we're kind of keeping it all at the same temperature just because we weren't going to fluctuate with that with much. But for our experiences, it made a big difference in terms of pushing those crops in a healthy place, not just in, like, you know, trying to grow really tall seedlings, nothing like that, but really just having a nice sturdy stockling seedling. And it's everything. Like, we had spinach transplants that we were using to get an early spinach crop. Lots of things that other growers in the area were saying, hey, you know, these transplants look really nice. So giving a thought to that, and certainly we don't own our land. That's why we haven't made a lot of strategic investments in our property. If we get to that hurdle, probably we'll look at bench heating systems. And, you know, I think from a long-term perspective, that's a really great way to think about trying to make sure you're bringing that heat towards the root zone. So. Yeah, so the question about using germination mats, yeah, we use a couple of good quality germination mats, and we're just basically using them to get stuff started. It's the way that we can actually grow a tomato transplant without having an air-heated greenhouse. There's definitely some question about stressing out. It's probably the furthest thing from what John's going to recommend for you to do, because it means we sometimes have plants like nightshades going through 40-degree nights in April. But for us, we always do succession planting of any of our major important crops, including our nightshades, and that's partially because we're working within that natural system. So if we start things without a lot of additional heat in the springtime, if we happen to get a really cool spring, it doesn't make sense. You know, we're scale back that planting and push more on the next planting, so on and so forth. So in terms of setting up the greenhouse, the other really big factor from my personal experience in terms of growing great quality transplants is really looking at airflow and thinking about what you're doing to make sure that you're getting good airflow through those seedlings. And a lot of things, this is the big question for us as commercial growers, is how do we do all these things that we know is the right thing to do, so to speak, but able to do it kind of affordably. So this is the question about flat sizes and thinking a lot about what you're going to be doing in terms of growing starts in the greenhouse. Is there any commercial grower in here where they feel like their propagation house is just tons and tons of room in the middle of May or late April, right? It's generally not the experience. I mean, most of the times I've ever gone into a commercial farm, and ours is the same way, we get to a point where, you know, we're a week behind transplanting, but we're still kind of getting our starts going for the next round of transplanting, and you get to the point where your whole greenhouse is basically just jam full. And that is a consideration for us that we want to kind of push people to think about, is oversizing your propagation greenhouse, and especially if you can stage heat it using, you know, basically curtains or other types of heating things where you're not having to heat that entire space, but so that you're giving yourselves the adequate space for these seedlings to be developed with that airflow in consideration. So of course, for tomatoes, for example, the traditional rule of thumb is to do something to kind of give them a little bit of stress, right, or to brush the tops of the tomatoes to help keep them a little bit stockier as they're growing. One of the other things that we were experimenting with last year and having good results is we weren't changing the cell size on our tomatoes, so we're not changing the cost of our potting soil at all, but starting to give those flats additional air space around them. So instead of cramming them in, you know, basically flat, 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 we'd give them space, flat, empty space, flat, empty space. And that was enough for us to actually start to create a little bit of a difference in the seedling production in terms of how stocky those plants were. And the reality is, it's really hard to afford to do that, right? Because you have this space, and oftentimes, especially if you're heating that space, it's always at a premium. But I think that if you're going to think about crops that are in the greenhouse for extended periods of time, especially the nightshade crops or some of the brassicas, one of the things that we really would encourage is trying to oversize your propagation house. And if you're going to be in a commercial operation for a long period of time, that cost is going to be quite easy to come back to it. You know, so maybe you think you need a 20 by 50 foot house, you know, maybe look like a 30 by 50 foot house or so on and so forth. Any questions on that idea of making sure that you have adequate space to give good airflow? Okay, compost related question of the potting soil.
You're going to mix your compost with existing potting soil? I'm just wondering what ratios
If you're going to mix your compost with existing potting soil, I haven't been mixing my own compost with potting soil for about 6 or 7 years, and it's because I don't make perfectly weed-free compost, and the labor cost of doing this to pull out little weeds hasn't been worth it to me, so I couldn't really give you a decision on that. I think the best thing to do would be to run some trials at different ratios and see what the different seedlings will go with that. So. So for the folks in the room that say, we can't have this space, a lot of it's going to be starting to think about what would be ideal, right? Has anybody seen a tomato seedling grown in a 3-gallon pot? But the size of those it's obviously not going to be the 4-inch seedling that John is speaking of. What's the smallest cell size somebody here grows a tomato seedling in, out of curiosity?
2 inches?
Commercial growers. Skip, how small do you go?
72
trays. 72s. Anybody go smaller than 72s on tomatoes? Start them and then pot them up. And so one of the things that you're going to probably get a better quality seedling if you can give that a larger soil volume for that crop to grow. And that's sort of well understood if you look at difference. But from a cost of production standpoint, obviously it's going to take up larger and larger spaces in your greenhouse. So one of the things that we're often recommending to folks is run some trials. We did this last year with our winter squash. We normally grow our winter squash in 50s and transplant those out generally around between 10 and 14 days. And I'll talk about transplanting timing in a sec. But last year we tried to grow some in 24s, which we don't think we want to do necessarily because we're not sure we'd have the space to do it, but we wanted to see what those transplants looked like. And there's definitely a stockier, not nearly as elongated transplant, and the only difference was the fact that we're giving them that added airflow that you get with a 24, round plug, so they're not all right next to each other as opposed to a 50 flat.
Well, and more media is much better. When people come to me and talk about growing in 300s, we try to say, well, it can be done, but we push people back towards 128s if possible. We don't like to get involved in cells much smaller. That or lettuce. Somebody's growing tomatoes in 128s, we know they're going to most likely have problems. Big variation in hydration, the temperature changes, and they really don't have enough because the bioreaction needs a certain amount of space. Part of the goal of making a great potting soil, there are two things you can do. You can get a bigger pot to have more space, and you can have more particles within. So that's what it is.
Could folks in this side of the room hear? No, okay, so the general rule there is more media is more forgiving. And we've thought about that, especially if we ever am concerned about transplant timing. If we can, we're air towards a larger cell size if we're going to be running up against any sort of bind, whether that's weather. So that might be an example of, growing lettuce plugs in 128s. And maybe if we get to a spot where we're sort of thinking, we want to be able to have the flexibility of holding these plants in the greenhouse for a longer period of time, we might grow those lettuce plugs in 98s for a little while. It sort of all depends on, what you're going to be coming up against in that growing season. And from a cost perspective, a lot of times we're going back to space, right? I mean, a lot of times if you think about, the cost, if you actually add up the cost of your potting media per plant and put that out over your garden, even on our scale where we're growing lots of transplants, we're buying in 60-quart bags because we don't really have the convenience of being able to work with sling bags on our farm very easily. That cost at the grand scheme of things for that plant is so minimal. So very minimal that it's really, especially on the commercial side of the production, it's pretty easy to incorporate that cost. And anything that's a long season crop, like a tomato, going back to yesterday's conversation about, 7 pounds or 11 pounds or 15 pounds or 20 pounds, per plant, really that cost is pretty easy to absorb if all you need to do is, barely get one of those tomatoes to be a little bit heavier on the vine. So I'm going to talk a little bit more and then I'll come back to questions in 1 second. So really, really emphasizing this idea of scaling the propagation house kind of appropriately to meet your needs. And oftentimes it's much bigger than what we think of for commercial growers. There's a lot of opportunity if you have the land base to be sort of multitasking with your propagation houses. You know, your propagation house can become your curing spot for onions and winter squash. It can be where you're growing crops in the wintertime. So utilizing that space, I know it's easier and easier to have tons of places under plastic. One of the things when we're thinking about making sure that we have a good growth pattern, and when we were doing research last year for our workshop on calcium and silica and boron at the NOFA Winter Conference, there's a lot of good research out there about having adequate calcium at the early stages of growth, because it actually allows the cells to replicate in a way that's sort of this, you know, healthy cell formation. And if they're deficient of that, sometimes they might bring other things into their cell walls besides calcium, and that replication pattern will get built up into that plant over time. So one of the things that we're trying to do in the early stages is making sure that the patterns that we're setting for growth are going to be those patterns which are going to set us up for success. For a lot of times, the commercial sense, that's thinking about when you're going to be doing the transplanting, what point of the life cycle. And we're in sort of that specialized niche, which we're not doing any mechanical transplanting, so we have the luxury of being able to transplant over a very wide spectrum. We don't have to necessarily have a fully formed root ball all the time, which I experience is gives us a lot of flexibility, especially when it comes to cucurbits. We can push our cucurbit transplants out. You know, sometimes we put summer squash and zucchini and winter squash out, you know, 7 to 10 days after we seeded them, when they're just basically getting a single cotyledon as early as it possibly can be kind of comfortable to work with. In that case, we might be using a transplant just to give us uniform densities in the field. If you're in a commercial operation where you're using a carousel transplanter or a water wheel transplanter, you don't have quite as much of that flexibility, which is, so one of those ideas is starting to think about what's the appropriate cell size that we can get this rooted up in a manageable, handleable way as quickly as possible in its growth pattern, so that we're not sort of holding it back or stunting those plants. Does that make sense? Is there a question?
Yeah.
Julie.
What would be your ideal time to plant a cucurbit if you just wanted it for its sake?
For the cucurbit's sake?
How long would you keep it in the greenhouse?
It all depends on the time of year that you're planting. And you're going to put it out June 1st. Generally speaking, we'd be looking at 2 weeks for a summer squash or zucchini and maybe 3 weeks for a cucumber, but it all depends. Like, May might have a warm spell that pushes growth a little bit quicker, a little bit slower, and it's looking at, I mean, cucumbers are sort of notoriously the biggest pain in the butt to transplant from keeping a nice stocky plant, because they want to just get leggy, especially if they're in the 50s, or some growers do 72s for cucumbers. You know, it depends. We do, I was talking with somebody last week about lettuce seedlings. We do lettuce mix, 4 seeds to a cell in 1/28. It's how we do our little juvenile lettuce mix. And in the height of the summer, it might only be 16 or 17 days after seeding if the germination is only 3 or 4 days on that lettuce. It's only growing for about 2 weeks. It all depends on the speed of its growth. And certainly, if you're taking care of the soil temperature, taking care of the nutrition, taking care of the water requirements, you often see the plant growing to, you know, a time for transplanting a lot quicker than it would otherwise. And as much as we talk about this, I don't want to get into a point where it's like, oh my gosh, if we didn't do this, we're screwed. We had an experience in 2010 when our first daughter was born. She was born in May, and we had scaled up the farm, and we were working some new land down the road, and that new land down the road was cover cropped. So, you know, it was one of those things where we didn't get to mowing the cover crop as early as we wanted to, so it was taking us a little bit longer to get our beds prepped. And we had started our winter squash transplants for that field, as typical timing for us is sometime in the late May, and, you know, those beds were nowhere near ready when the plants were really ready to be transplanted the, you know, second week of June. So we purposefully just started to kind of hold those guys back. This is the you know, again, different than what John's going to tell you to do. But we knew that we couldn't get those in the ground, but those are the transplants we actually wanted to place out. So we just basically kind of really held back water, kind of tried to make sure their growth was as minimal as possible at that stage, and effectively put out these gnarly transplants that, you know, were certainly basically 5 weeks old by the time they went in the ground, probably had to pinch some flowers off as we were transplanting. and we still got a decent crop out of that. And I've had experiences that same year as a special year in a sense. We grew some tomato plants. I normally do 3 successions of tomatoes. The last succession is always just the hope and the prayer for a beautiful fall, and then you got, you know, nice tomatoes for October. And so those ones, we don't pot on those tomatoes because they're the ones that are seeded generally the last week of May or first week of June in the greenhouse, and it just requires too much work to do any potting on in June because we're too busy. So I grow those in 50s or 98s. That year I grew them in 98s, and we totally neglected those tomato transplants. And they were, you know, spindly little things like this, and we put them out in the ground, and we still had a beautiful tomato crop that came on in September. So even though we're talking about what we want to do is the ideal, keep in mind that, you know, just because you haven't necessarily done your best, you can still oftentimes make do with what you have. For us, a lot of times we're talking about these pattern points, and we're also talking about the leverage points. I think John talks about it, the critical points of influence. But so we started doing nutrient drenches or transplant drenches probably the first year we were on the farm. And part of the idea was the handling cost of that flat, literally picking that flat up and moving it, in our case, to a garden cart or to a truck where we're going to bring it out to the field to transplant, that requires labor. So we wanted to think about any time that we're engaging that labor cost, what can we do to make that labor actually have some benefit for us? So what that ultimately for us is looking at this idea of a plant transplant drench. And on the garden scale, this is pretty easy. You can certainly just do a root soak of your seedling and then put the seedling in the ground and then take the extra drench material and just water it in. On the smaller commercial scale, which we're not using any mechanical transplanting, what we've done is taken a nice big Rubbermaid feed trough, and we fill it up about 20 or 30 gallons. It's probably half full. It depends on what kind of transplants we're putting in and how tall they are. And just as we're bringing our transplants out to put them on the truck or the garden cart, we stick 2 or 3 of them in to soak up some nutrients and then throw them onto the garden cart. It slows the process down, but as a portion of the overall time in that interaction, it's not that great of a additional task. And then for the large commercial growers, if you're using water wheel transplanters, you're in the best place because that is literally just, you know, the time it takes for you to fill up the water wheel, unless you're using a nice pressurized pump, is going to take you a little bit of time with the garden hose, and it's pretty easy just to put some nutrients into that water wheel transplanter. If you're using a carousel transplanter, this is one of those spots where you've lost that leverage point because you don't have that opportunity to be doing this drenched quite as easily as with the water wheel transplanter. Did you have a question? Yeah, and you know, if somebody left the hose on a little bit too long, sometimes we flip a 10-20 on the bottom of it to make sure the flat can sit on something. So the question was, you know, how we're effectively actually soaking these. We won't necessarily try to get the leaf all wet. It might happen occasionally, but that's where if we have a little lettuce seedling, we make sure our water's a little bit lower than if we do with a tomato or things of that nature. And the idea here is just taking this action. We're going to take this labor. Labor is expensive. Anytime you're doing anything with the plants on the farm is expensive. So moving these flats, literally picking them up and moving them onto the truck, that costs money, or cost labor, which is money. And so we're going to think about what we can do to kind of make sure that we're capitalizing on that labor expense. So a question in the back? Yep. So here's what our ingredients are that we normally have in a plant transplant solution, and I'll talk specifics in 1 second. But basically for us, we're often putting calcium out almost all the time, trying to make sure we have good available calcium and also good available phosphorus to kind of stimulate root activity. We will put on biologicals, inoculants. So sometimes if we're using, for example, a Biogenesis Ateneo product that's fairly expensive, we sometimes will put that into our transplant drench as a way to re-inoculate that seedling. In reality, what we've been doing on our farm mostly is we've been taking our aerated compost tea and putting that into the drench bin, or the bucket, if you will. oftentimes some sort of sugar to feed or stimulate that biology, sometimes some enzymes or biostimulants, liquid seaweed, things of that nature. So without getting into, you know, necessarily proprietary, saying that this is the way to do it, this is just legitimately what we do on our farm last year. We took 15 to 30 gallons of water, and this isn't in your handouts, I apologize, because I just put it in the other night. But we've been using Foundation, but basically calcium, phosphorus, and traces. You could make a soft rock slurry. I have a gardener who works makes a soft rock slurry to get the calcium and phosphorus. That's a great way to do that pretty inexpensively. Doesn't have all the traces necessarily that John's Foundation has in it, but has the same idea of that calcium and phosphorus. We put a little bit of liquid kelp in. Again, that stimulant for root health. Sea crop is a microbial food, trace minerals are microbial inoculant. We're using a company down in New Mexico that produced a complete inoculant, but there's a lot of them out there. Liquid fish, we use a lot of liquid fish on the farm. Organic Gem is a fish fertilizer in New Bedford, so we have that readily available. It's, you know, 4 miles from the farm. Some enzymatic stimulants, equisetum extraction, which is silica, that's a biodynamic preparation. We're just putting that, again, kind of like the compost tea. We have lots of silica on the farm, so we might as well put it where we need about it. And some molasses. And I will, anything that got slid in here that wasn't in the handout, we will make the PDF available so you can have all this stuff after. I should have said that before people started writing notes. But it's good to give your hands an exercise. If you price all that out and say you want to do it, say you're going to do it for a 1,000 square foot bed, maybe you're doing lettuce transplants, so you've got 7 flats, you can obviously use, we often will do it for, you know, 3 or 4 beds worth. But if you wanted to do it for every 1,000 square foot bed, the price of this is around $2 per bed. It's about $80 per acre with those ingredients. So again, when we're thinking about the costs, this is an added fertility expense that a lot of growers haven't historically put on, or maybe they're maybe just putting a little bit of fish in the water wheel transplanter, but not necessarily doing all of the potpourri A to Z. But from an expense standpoint for us, all right, $2 per bed. All we need to do is figure out how to get $2 more per bed to cover the cost of this action. And odds are these actions are going to easily make that $2 per bed back for us with a healthier transplant. We talked about yesterday, one of the things I like to do is go back and dig that transplant up 24 hours after transplanting, and we want to make sure we have explosive root growth that's happening. And one of the ways that we started to feel like that was happening was not only making sure we're doing kind of a mineral pre-plant, but also doing this nutrient drench. So let's take a few questions on that.
You'd mentioned yesterday that plant jacket. It just occurred to me that if you put a plant in and then put another one beside it, you intended to pull up.
So the suggestion, and that's actually what I've often recommended, is if you're a home gardener and you can't sacrifice a plant, just make sure you have two to plant that day and you can pull one up to check on it. So the commercial growers, it's pretty easy because, you know, you got, you know, hundreds or thousands of plants, so it's pretty easy to check things up. Let's go in the back for a question. Why is silica on that list? We didn't talk as much about silica yesterday when we ran through our minerals, but there's a lot of good research out there in silica and plant health, and we have a lot of silica and silicon in our soils, but a lot of times it's not always plant available. And so I take my experience working on the biodynamic farm in Hawthorne Valley and also sort of spending time within the world of biodynamics and thinking about the importance of silica. So we make an equisetum, that's a horsetail plant, a tea out of that or extraction out of that, and we use that silica in a lot of different places on the farm. And that's something I can't necessarily back up with a lot of hard, fast evidence. But part of the idea is making sure that we're having that silica. The article by Hugh Lovell in the Reader will talk a lot about silica in that pathways of creating healthy plants. He calls it the bio sequence of healthy plants. So you can take a look into Hugh Lovell's article. Take a couple more questions if there were, and then.
I just want to talk about two.
Silica?
Or just this
transplant. Great. Let's get another mic on, or just pass the mic.
I can get that one if you want.
In terms of inoculating seeds, we're using Dan's shake method. I've also sometimes put a salt shaker of inoculant, and then just kind of depends on the quality and the cost of the seed and how important that crop is. But I've used Dan's method. But there's some seeds it doesn't always feel like you're getting much adhesion to. So in that case, sometimes as we're right before we're going to cover our flat, we'll just take our little salt shaker and sprinkle that. But it's a much more expensive way to do it because you're putting out more than you need.
I just had a couple comments about this process. I'm sorry I was out earlier. Did you talk about crop fertilizers and stuff like that?
No.
No. Okay, I didn't think so. John talked yesterday about the developmental stages and the points at which he called critical points of influence at which you lose yield potential. And he talked about that first, day 12 to 14 in corn to decide how many ears they're going to make, et cetera. In a lot of crops, I think that this moment when you plant the seed or transplant into the garden, into the field, is functionally has that effect. So getting into the ground, everything that the plant needs in a nice bioavailable form, in my experience, really gets rid of that first limiting factor stage. And if that's the most limiting factor, the most important, as in you lose 20 or 30 or 40% of your yield in that first 2 or 3 weeks, then focusing your fertility amendments, your complete in-season fertility amendments in this moment in the plant's life, I find to be extremely crucial. So really facilitates success nicely. I think this is a nice recipe here, Derek, put together. I've got a slightly modified one if you want, but this is, I generally don't use fish, but basically everything else I would totally subscribe to.
Is this for your transplant friend?
No, this is a dry blend.
Okay.
We haven't talked about fertilizer, right? All day long or yesterday long. This is what the term fertilizer means it has to have an NPK number on it, so this is not a fertilizer. This is just a basic, spring fertility amendment. Somebody who's done a good job in functioning biologically, got their basic minerals in place, et cetera, this is basically what I do. It's about 1,000 pounds an acre, and those are the percents. Can people read that in the back? 35% lime, 10% gypsum, 10% K-Mag. It'll be up there. People can come read it later if they want. 5% Redmond salt, 10% alfalfa, 5% kelp, 15% humates, 10% Tennessee brown rock phosphate. And the other one is more of a, gratuitous, generous thing. I've got at 25% compost, 20% alfalfa, 10% lime, 10% humates, 10% Dynamin, which is an azomite type, broad spectrum montmorillonite. Clay, zeolite has a really nice porosity holding structure, can hold nitrogen, anions, kelp, and Tennessee brown rock. So in my process, basically, I've got my permanent raised beds. They've gone through the winter. Right before I come through with my tiller at 1 inch deep, or Julie's tiller at 1 inch deep, I will spread this out on the bed and then integrate that in and then plant my seeds. So whether if I'm planting seeds, if I'm broadcasting seeds, I'll take a mix like this at something like these rates and water that onto the soil. I'd like to get soil conductivity up at the moment of planting or transplanting. This really helps do that. So,
yeah, good question.
Those are two different, fertilizers.
This is for the crops he really cares about, and these are the ones that...
If you haven't taken a soil test and you haven't, done a lot of your basic foundational stuff, the one on the left is, a good, solid, foolproof. It's going to be a little bit more expensive, probably. And the one on the right is more of for a farmer, I would suggest. Yes?
Is this when you're adding your trace minerals, like...
This is absolutely not when I'm adding the trace elements. The trace elements and the systemic mineral deficiency addressing happens in the fall, ideally. You take your soil test, ideally in September, get it back, figure out what you need, get what you need, and put it on the ground as soon as possible, hopefully in October, all your trace elements. And, if you need 500 pounds an acre of gypsum or 500 pounds an acre of green sand, all that happens in the fall. This is your, a lot of farmers use a 534 from North Country Organics. This is my sort of, to fit in that role, in that space. There's no animal products, there's no blood meal, there's no feather meal, there's no bone meal. I'm not working for an NPK number, I'm working for a good mineral recipe in that environment. And really, I feel like this is a very nice comprehensive fertility program. It really gets your plants everything they need, minimizes any deficiencies they might experience early in life, and really sets them off nicely.
And just to be clear, that's so.
This is a liquid component, and that's a dry component.
Same concept.
They're both are. I do both, and yeah. I strongly support both.
Yeah, let's just talk about that real quick. So, I'm just talking about what we're doing to that transplant before it gets to the field, and Dan's talking about this mineralization that happens in the field, and we do the same thing. It's a different recipe than what Dan has.
Yeah.
But the same idea is making sure that our connectivity is up, making sure we have a little bit of available nutrients for that transplant to go in, and it's partially because our potting soil media. If you look at the soil analysis for potting soil media, it tends to be pretty rich. That analysis is oftentimes a much nicer soil than what's going out into the garden. And, you know, I've had a lot of times back in the day where I can remember putting a transplant out and you come out, you know, 3 or 4 days later in a cool spring soil and it doesn't seem like that transplant's doing anything. And now what we're looking for is we don't see a transplant shock per se. We maybe have a slowdown in top growth while the plant's starting to develop root systems. But what we're looking for is that root system to get established right away. So it's the transplant drench is the that interaction point, but it's not necessarily foregoing the mineralization.
Yeah.
So
different processes for, so assuming you're going to be doing both of these things, you have me, like I said, before preparing the bed, put the dry down. Right, we talked about, you know, mulching and cover cropping and, you know, ideally permanent beds so you don't have to be doing much tilling. You've got your oats and your field peas and your forage radishes that all died in the winter. That bed is sitting there with all the dead plant material, and you need to go over that with a tiller to prepare a seed bed. Before you do that, before you go over it with a tiller, however you prepare your seed bed, spread this on top and integrate it into the top inch or two. A. Then you make, depending on how you're going to plant, I mean, different people have different policies and, you know, strategies based on what their infrastructure is, et cetera. If I'm going to put in a tomato plant, I would chop a hole with a hoe. I'd make a mix of those liquids, which are now gone. I'd make a mix of those liquids and with water and water that into the hole. So if I've got 1,000 square feet of tomato area that I'm going to plant, I'll take a 55-gallon drum and fill it with water and put in, you know, whatever it is, a quart of this concentrate and apply that out through a hose or something into all those holes and soak the holes before I put the transplant in. Does that make sense? So when I soak the hole, it's a lot of nice water in there. It's got all these goodies. That's where the root system is. And instead of watering it on top of the soil after you've transplanted, like if you've got all these inoculants in here that you want to have in contact with the root, and you water that on top of the soil after you transplant. Everybody sees the fallacy of our policies? You want that water with all the goodies in the hole or in the row where the seeds are going, not on top after you've covered it. Soaking the transplants is a policy that a lot of farmers do, which effectively gets that done.
And that's ultimately why the commercial growers that are using water wheel transplanters, that's where they have us beat on so many other factors, is that they can do this with such ease because it's basically just adding a little bit of something nutritionally to that water wheel transplanter. What is that shelf life? We don't pre-mix it. I know Dan and Julie, I think, do pre-mixes. It's certainly more convenient if you pre-mix it. But for ourselves, we don't bother. We just have a little like caddy with all of our ingredients that we hang out with in a spot that's, you know, inside the house, a little bit coolish. And we're just bringing that caddy and mix it. It does take a little bit more time, but it allows us to have some flexibility because sometimes we're like, oh, we're transplanting tomatoes today. Let's give them a little bit extra of this.
Yeah.
Or, hey, we're doing this. I haven't experienced with holding those
guys. I wouldn't mix the inoculants in until I was ready to use it. So all the minerals and, you know, stuff that's fairly shelf stable, I mix that all up ahead of time. But the inoculants, you know, once you put the inoculant in the water, you've got 4 hours max period, full stop, by which you must have gotten that water onto the ground. And so it does not sit overnight.
And my experience is to definitely stay away from mixing fish with other things until it's ready, because the fish has been stabilized and it's basically shelf stable in its form. But once you add it to other things, you never know what's going to happen with your fish products. So the question is, if you had a compost tea brewer, could you just add smaller amounts of this into your compost tea and then you'd be all set? We do both, to be perfectly honest. We put a lot of stuff into our compost tea, but I think you could absolutely do that. I think that one thing is, to some degree, partly we like these larger quantities of calcium and phosphorus to make sure we're really getting penetration into that root ball. And I'm not sure you'd get the same concentration, because you might be putting in some things that would kind of over-concentrate your brew. John's products are nice because they don't change the chemistry so much, because they're not soluble, they're available. But that's, you know, there's other things out there on compost tea. This list is pretty long, and that's why this is the ingredient. This is, you know, you don't have to get this complex. Basically, what you're talking about is making sure that you're providing some of the mineral nutrition. Trace minerals definitely go towards heavier application. Make sure you have good calcium and phosphorus out there. Again, soft rock slurry is an easy way to do that. And then think about making some biologicals with compost tea or inoculants, you name it. It doesn't have to be this complex, but it can be. And once you get into it, again, the cost of this is not so much. The labor cost of mixing it on a regular basis is going to be a lot more than just the cost of the ingredients. And there's products that are regularly, you know, there's, you know, pre-transplant liquids out there that are on the marketplace. So if you want to go that direction.
I just want to say one thing about the calcium and the phosphorus. It's a really important point. I think John brought it up yesterday as well. For root growth, you must have calcium and phosphorus available to the plant to use. And when you're taking a seedling and putting it into the soil, and it's in the spring in many cases, and cold, and calcium is sluggish and phosphorus is tied up, in many cases, when we put our transplants into the ground, we don't have availability of those crucial components necessary to establish a functional root system. John talked about the role of the root system and the hormone balance, and you always want to keep the roots bigger than the top. getting some calcium and some phosphorus, you know, in a, I'm recommending, you know, a finely ground form, non-soluble but highly bioavailable, really facilitates that root development. We had a workshop at Derek's farm a couple years ago, and Derek did this really nice little experiment. He, like he's been saying, he was, you know, transplanted some seedlings the day before, or 2 days, was it one day before? And we, you know, pulled them up, and he had done all this stuff. And the fur of new roots that had were just grown out from that root ball was amazing. I mean, it was obviously had come from the root ball into the soil, and it was furry. I mean, it was full of roots. And that's what you want to see. You really want to see new root growth as soon, you know, 24 hours after you put that seedling into the ground. That means it's getting off to a really good foundational, you know, start. And oftentimes, I mean, many people have had the experience, I'm sure, of putting in some broccoli in the spring and, you know, come back a week later and it's about the same size it was, and you come back the next week and the flea beetles have showed up, and, you know, 3 days after that, they're all gone. Anybody done that in the spring? Yeah, that's soil conductivity, that's soil mineral availability, at $2 a bed. I mean, it's really very inexpensive, and you address so many systemic issues. So along with the fertility, you know, basic management practices I was talking about this morning, I find that this, you know, this 1-2 punch here really sets the stage for almost no more work for the rest of the year. You really get a lot of your systemic issues addressed through this. Yes.
Well, so my experience is if we get a root-bound seedling on our farm, we often don't do anything to that seedling because it's just cost too much time to be playing with the seedling when we're transplanting, but on a home garden scale, you certainly can do that. I will say that when we started kind of focusing a little bit more on this approach, even though we have a root boundness, new root growth still seems to come quite a bit. The bigger concern I have is looking at when you pull those roots up. The other time we like to pull roots up is the end of the season. You're going back and doing your final assay. Well, what was my brassica root really like? How did we do? Or how did that Swiss chard plant really look like? And certainly if you have those root bound seedlings that are wrapping it all, I think it's a good idea to think if you have the time to be able to break them apart, because otherwise when you go back to the end of the year, what you have is it looks like big fingers that are wrapped around each other because those root systems were trying to enlarge, and at some point they probably reached a maximum.
I rip mine open.
Yep.
Yeah, Linda.
Oh, good question, yeah, because I skipped over that. So these leverage points are these pattern points. Foliar sprays, we do quite a bit of foliar sprays, and we'll talk about them in a little bit on the farm. But foliar sprays in your greenhouse are really inexpensive to do because you're often covering a very limited amount of space. And that's one of the ways that we've addressed kind of making sure that we have all the nutrients on the scene. I haven't looked as much into detail, but there's good data, like if you look, as John was talking with corn, that zinc needs to be present really early in the stage because that's when it's starting to develop, you know, how many embryos it's going to develop and so on and so forth. So for us, that's a good point for us to do foliar sprays. So on our farm, what that looks like practically speaking is we do foliars about once a week in the springtime. It's really easy to find that time before you're into the harvest season. In the harvest season, we keep one day a week. We harvest for the farm stand 7 days a week, but we have one morning a week that we pull everybody but one person off of the harvest and they do fertility work that morning. So whether that's side dressing or foliar sprays or nutrient drenches or whatever, it's a couple hours out of our week that we say we think this is an important enough thing that we're going to put it into our schedule in the same way that we might put harvesting and stuff into our schedule. The other thing that we're doing, and this is a, you know, you can experiment with that, is we're doing two other things in the greenhouse. One is with alliums or something, if we see that we've had them in the greenhouse for a long time and they're slowing down, we'll do a heavy drench of fish or something to bring some nitrogen just to kind of spark that ignition again. And then this past year, we're doing a lot of work just using a hose-on injector and basically once a week putting a drench in through our watering system. And that's, you know, pretty easy to do. It's a very similar ingredient list to what was on the When we do the drench, you're saying? It's just getting our town water with, like I said, a fixed carbon to tie up the bad stuff. And then once a week, we would add a drench. So basically, we use this little hose-on injector, right? Comes out of 5 gallons. It's the cheapest kind of injector you can get as opposed to getting into, like, you know, dosatrons and stuff like that. And it'll suck anything out of a 5 gallon bucket and put it into solution into our sprayer. And we use that, and we have a fixed thing going on with that all the time. And then once a week, we're going to add a bunch of other things to that. Oh, that.
What's the recipe?
Oh, what's the stuff we're adding to that drench? It's very similar to this list. It might not be quite the same, and I'd have to go back and look at the list of stuff. I don't think we've been putting inoculants in there so much. We don't do fish. We don't put nitrogen in on a weekly basis. That's not so necessary. But a lot of times, it's a little bit of foundation and a little bit of sea minerals, basically.
And the one other thing you can do for foliar spraying seedlings is foliar inoculants. We've talked about seed inoculants and soil inoculants. That's the rhizosphere. But you also have the phylloplane, which is the leaf surface. And establishing a healthy biological ecosystem on the leaf surface early in the plant's life is very profound in its effect. They're just, it's another broad spectrum inoculant. I use the one from Tainio called Micro 5000, which is a foliar inoculant. I've seen, you know when your seedlings sometimes they're green, but they're not like a really, really green? We know what I'm talking about. Yeah, like I've seen that just change overnight from a nice, you know, green to like deep, thick. The leaves are thicker, the color's darker, there's more hairs on the leaves. Really signs of much greater vitality through a foliar inoculant early in the plant's life. It really sets them up nicely.
I just want to say that if you can afford nothing else, get some Micro 5000 for your foliars.
Julie says if you can afford nothing else, get some Micro 5000.
And it's an expensive product, so we've initially very often just used it in the greenhouse.
Yeah.
And because it's, you know, if you put it on the application rate, it's expensive per acre, but if you just put it in the greenhouse, it's pretty easy.
Tainio.
We just mix it right into our backpack sprayer. Goes into solution.
So
Aaron.
You don't need to use the micro or not. If you prefer that leaf or not, is it sufficient just to do it at the seedling stage so you wouldn't need to do it in the field?
I think they recommend, you know, two or three times through the entire growth cycle of the plant. The thing about foliar inoculants, which I wanted to be able to touch on at some point here, is we certainly can buy these things in bottles, but there's also a lot of really good information out there about going out and harvesting these inoculants from your local environment and making these teas and making these inoculants out of plants. In general, I think I recommend as part of your weekly schedule is that you go for a walk. You're obliged as part of your fertility program to take the dog or the wife or the kids and hit as many microclimates as possible. Take a 5-gallon bucket and get whatever leaves are in full, beautiful color. So early in the spring, you got skunk cabbage, right? And then you got, ferns. You know, in the middle of the summer, August, you got goldenrod is beautiful. And you know, just think about all the different plants that are striking and looking exquisite at any given point in time. Every week, go for a walk, see if you can hit forest, meadow, swamp, field edges. When the pigweed is looking, you know, ridiculously vital, harvest the pigweed. See if you can get some lichen off the north side of a tree, some moss off of a stone, really think about multiple family types of organisms, and you take all that stuff that you've put in your 5-gallon bucket and you go and you cover it with, you know, lukewarm water and let it sit overnight. And the next morning, come out and pour it out, and you've got a very rich biological inoculant from all the plants that are in full phase right now, you know, full on energy, vitality, and you can apply that to your plants. Really, really powerful stuff. So you don't need to buy the stuff. You certainly can for commercial scale growers. It's oftentimes, you know, most efficient and advantageous, but I really think, you know, talking about scheduling things, you're obliged to go for a walk once a week and go harvest things from your local nature and use them.
Or once a month. I mean, talking about the economics, so we are 5 miles from the ocean, and we use concentrated sea minerals because, to be perfectly honest, in the height of the busy growing season for me, it's easier for me to just go to those concentrated sources than to have, you know, somebody going down to the ocean to get seawater. So, and that might sound absolutely insane to you, but it's the reality of a busy growing season and trying to figure out where you want to spend your time. Going back to the foliar sprays in the greenhouse in the springtime, if you have perennial plantings, your fruits and brambles and things like that, that's how we practically do it, is if we're going to do a foliar spray in March, first week of March, second week of March, you know, we're going to mix up a whole backpack just because it's easy that way. It's more material than you need for your greenhouse, so that's the material you use to foliar spray those fruit brambles and stuff.
Skip.
So a really key point that Skip's making is that root growth, so he's doing eight acres of brassicas, that root growth is basically his key to his Lely blind cultivation because he's not pulling plants out of the ground as quickly because the root systems have been established. So absolutely, yeah, we don't do any mechanical cultivation on the farm, but if we did, especially with tine weeders, this would be something to spend money on.
And I think most farmers here are in the couple acre range, maybe up to 10 if they're doing vegetables, but Skip's one of those few big vegetable farmers we have in New England. So you've been trying this out on a relatively commercial scale, and what can you just give us a quick, you know, feedback on what your experience has been, what you've, if I may? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think if you're going to... So of all the things you do here and there, this is one thing you do everywhere. I would second that motion.
All right, so
one more guy in the back.
Oh yeah, Mike. Well, so for us, there's sort of, we use the question is, what are these sources of calcium and phosphorus that aren't water soluble but available? And, we've used John's products, and whatever, but the other local gardeners that I know that, wanted to do stuff like this, didn't want to go into that product side of things, started just making soft rock slurry, which is taking soft rock phosphate. And I think they're putting a cup into a gallon and just stirring it up and letting it sit around for an hour or two and just taking the milky liquid off of that. And I don't know, I mean, you'd have to actually look at lab analysis and see, but anecdotally, Steve Wallach, who's a gardener near us, had really good results, he felt like, with that. For the home gardeners in the room, if anybody wants to take a tour to Dartmouth, you're welcome to come see the farm sometime. We're going to have a field day this June, and maybe we're partnering with our neighbor at Friends Academy, who we had a course with a while ago, but Steve Wallach, he runs a garden with his kids there, and they have 1,800 square feet of bed space, and this year they grew about 5,800 pounds of food in that 1,800 square feet. The footprint of that entire garden is less than a tenth of an acre, and again, almost 6,000 pounds of food. So there's some opportunities to think about, from a commercial perspective, it's all about, for us, it's a lot of times it's related to the bottom line. Ultimately, it's related to making sure that we have customers that appreciate what we're growing. But for the home gardener perspective, there's a lot of opportunity when you start to think about this to make sure that you're getting the yield response for the labor that you're putting into your garden.
It's soft rock phosphate. Everybody knows what soft rock phosphate is? Calphos, comes from Florida. It's called Calphos, C-A-L-P-H-O-S. I think you guys have the best price around. Lancaster Ag, generally, if you're looking for quantity, it's called colloidal calcium, and that means that there's basically a very, very small particle size, and it's calcium phosphate with a broad spectrum of traces in it. So basically, if you take a pound of that, rock phosphate, and you put it in a gallon of water or a 5-gallon bucket of water, and you stir it up, and you come back tomorrow, that water will still be milky. It will still be milky, because it's so small that it's still standing in solution. And so that means you've got a very, very small particle size, which means you have a very high bioavailability. And if you take that slurry and you add some humates, which are stable carbon, they will bond to that, and you add a little bit of fish and a little bit of inoculants and some sea minerals, you've got some charge, you've got some food, and you've got a mix that is, very stimulative to life. So it's not, that's one component, and that's how you can make it if you want to make it yourself. But certainly it's all the pieces together that really, every single one of those pieces in the puzzle has a reason for being there. I don't use actually Equisetum or fish. What's that? It doesn't clog up my sprayer.
No, the soft rock slurry? Yeah, no, if you put it on really thick, it wouldn't be enough of it. But yeah, if you're using it to dilute, I think I've been putting in no more than a cup per gallon or something like that.
And this is not a foliar
about
material.
Soft rock slurry.
This mix is to go into the hole or into the row before you plant. So it's going to go through a hose or a watering can or a irrigation system of some sort. It's not going through a foliar spraying.
But that being said, we put soft rock slurry in our foliars,
yes,
as well.
Cool.
Can you guys say why you don't use fish, why you do use fish?
Yeah, do you want to start?
I have a philosophical standpoint that is that I don't need to add nitrogen. That's because I think that there's plenty in the atmosphere. And if my plants haven't figured out how to get it for themselves, I haven't done a good job of getting them established, and they shouldn't continue to grow.
I have maybe a more traditional commercial grower's approach, which is if I've already put time and effort and energy into something, if it's not growing well, I want to fix the problem. But I want to delineate a couple things. The only time we're really using fish from a nitrogen source to really get a growth response in the crop is if we're going to go and drench like an allium in the greenhouse and we're putting on a pretty dense level. When we're putting fish on, this is 6 ounces of fish to 1,000 square feet. You know, that's going to work out to be 2 gallons to the acre. A lot of times, from a nitrogen perspective, if you do the math, very little nitrogen. What we're putting that fish on is actually to be fungal food and be biological food and to be something to kind of feed that biological system. So we're not thinking of fish so much as that huge nitrogen push. Yeah. If we were, in the recommendation, I've seen a recommendation, 55 gallons of fish to the acre, then you're actually going to get some nitrogen out of that system. But at 2 gallons to the acre, you're really just putting that on to feed the system. So, yeah. And then the reason we use it is, we live 4 miles from the processing plant. So it's, we literally can, what's the transportation cost for this product? It's me driving my pickup truck down to Organic Gem and saying hello to the guys and chatting with them and then getting a big drum in the back of the truck.
For me, actually, there's another component about the fish, which is that I think that fish is extremely unsustainable, and I have a personal problem with the way the oceans are being emptied. And regardless of whether it's a byproduct and it's available now or not, I don't think it's going to be an available byproduct long into the future. I think I like to use my things that are readily available in large quantities on principle.
And we could debate because I come from a fishing family.
They cut the cod.
My in-laws are fishermen. They hold on to their fishing industry. They actually sold their quotas the last 2 years because their quotas have been so low. But for the most part, they're using dogfish for this fish, and it's a relatively sustainable fishery. There's different types of species out there. Certain species are being well managed. There's certainly the cod are not one of those. They're trying to do a better job. But it's also one of those things that you scale back and say, well, is it appropriate for us? But then how is it appropriate for everybody in the world to be doing it? And if you look at a lot of the liquid fishes, you get in the Midwest, it's carp from the rivers. And if you go down south, it's catfish. And the catfish, obviously, is not necessarily the same sustainability of ocean fish. The question is, do we worry about the contamination that comes with that fish, the heavy metals and the toxicities from the ocean? So there's a couple things going on there. Number one is people always ask us about that with seaweed as well. And certainly, we're not eating, bay scallops from the inner city of New Bedford that have high levels of PCB, which is, also a thing that's considered to be toxic. There was a research study done, somebody doing, PhD or master's degree research, looking at what happens when they're dredging New Bedford Harbor, where it's a Superfund site. New Bedford Harbor is going to cost $20 million to clean that site up. And they were looking at the PCB levels of tomatoes that were being grown in Dartmouth versus Acushnet, basically upwind or downwind of the harbor. And not so surprisingly, downwind of the harbor had higher levels of PCBs in their tomatoes than where we were. But the levels that were in that were so minuscule compared to other pathways to exposure in most people's diets that it wasn't a major contribution. So for myself, where I've come with the reality of toxicities, and John talked a little bit about this yesterday, this idea that there's no organic, free place. There's studies that came out of Europe that were saying, organics had higher levels of heavy metals and it was just from atmospheric deposition. I'm of sort of the opinion that we are probably going to be bombarded with all of that stuff in our environment, and if we're doing a good job of creating the biological community to help kind of basically deal with that toxicity, then the benefit is going to outweigh the sort of, bombardment of bad things. So from ocean stuff, for me, I wouldn't go get it out of the worst part of the ocean, but we'd sort of look towards, again, we're not going to look at bioaccumulator species, we're not putting on tuna and, other types of high-level things.
I think that's a really good point about the functionality of the biological system. Somebody was making a point here during the break about toxicity and environmental pollutants. We have all sorts of pollutants everywhere in the environment, fact. And from my perspective, you can get worked up about this one or that one or the other one or any of a large number of them. There's nice maps that have shown, you know, all the nuclear fallout after all the, you know, tests that were done in the 40s and 50s and 60s. I mean, the whole country got a nice, good dose of radioactive isotopes, right? The whole place. We got slammed. And then there's DDT, and then there's everything else. And then there was Fukushima. I mean, there's all sorts of pollutants in the atmosphere and in the environment. And the interesting information for me is stuff that came out of Austria after Chernobyl. There was a family called the Lubkes, who are compost makers, biologists, and the story that I've heard was that after Chernobyl, the Austrian government was coming through and checking the produce people's farms, and wherever they found radioactive isotopes, they said you can't sell, and all the farms surrounding the Lubkes were disallowed from selling because they had radioactive isotopes on their crops, and they couldn't find any radiation on the Lubkes farm. It was obviously falling everywhere around them and probably falling on their farms, but something was happening to digest it and so that it was not there anymore. And my understanding is bacteria and fungi, you know, they eat protons, electrons for breakfast. I mean, they, you know, all this transmutation stuff we're talking about and referring to is real, and all the PCBs and all the sort of the, you know, heavy organic compounds that are carcinogenic, those are just carbons and hydrogens and oxygens in long chains. And the bacteria and the fungi can break those down into their component parts, you know, readily, and they do. And when you talk about lead or, you know, chromium or whatever other heavy metal you're concerned about, they take those and they complex them into very insoluble, very stable molecules that, while they may still be present in the soil, they're no longer bioavailable. But it's the bacteria and the fungi that really do this job of cleaning up our environment, and they're the only ones that can. And it's again, you know, back to the foundation of building the biological system. And when you do that, you know, all these issues are systemically addressed in a very holistic fashion. I think Holly had a question too. Can I talk about why the Fedco catalog says don't apply soft rock phosphate with lime? Carrie Reams strongly suggested you do that. When you do it, if you, like I said before, there's a couple week period where there's a lot of energy being released, and if you put seeds in the ground, they will burn and not, you know, they won't germinate. They'll get fried because too much energy is being released. But that energy being released is actually very beneficial to your overall soil. So it's a great way to stale seed bed. If you're going to be doing some stale seed bedding, you know, put a little bit of rock phosphate down, a little bit of limestone down. That'll take care of your weeds that germinate. It'll fry them just as well as it'll fry your seedlings. So that may be why, but I don't know. I wouldn't know of any other reason.
My experience with that is they're recommending that because they feel like the plant might start taking calcium up out of the lime, and then it's not going to break the calcium phosphorus bond in the soft rock phosphate. But, you know, I think that's more of a traditional approach. And to me, soft rock phosphate, I mean, Reams, of course, he was in Florida, so he's in a place where it was wildly abundant, but he had a lot of really good experiences with its utilization in farm. He was an agronomist consultant, basically. He did a lot of work kind of like what John's doing now. So, you know, those are the people, like, if they actually had good positive results, somebody like Skip has a good experience with something, they say, well, we're going to keep using that. So if it was used as widely as it was with Reams, it's something that we think is a really valuable and also something worth shipping around the globe. So, all right, a final thing about this drench aspect, which is that $80 per acre, again, this was if you're going to mix this drench up and apply it to a 1,000 square foot bed with those soaks. In reality, say, you know, we're there, it's tomato transplanting day. You know, tomato transplanting day for us might be putting out, you know, 5 beds of tomatoes, and we might use the same soak for those 5 beds. So that cost per acre, that's the $80 is on the high end. If you know, you could really, if you were nickel and diming this, you know, you could do that on $20 an acre. It's not, you know, from a dollar perspective, a very significant investment, and I really want to kind of stress that, because basically all we're thinking about is what are these investments we're making, and I didn't kind of lay this out as much yesterday as I did last year, but the concern for me is the labor costs are so high when we're involved with organic production, and we really want to make sure that the return for our labor is adequate. And so, you know, if you put a plant out there that doesn't fail, you know, kind of fails to thrive, then basically you are devaluing all that labor along the process. And since I'm trying to, so, you know, our family is a single income family. I raise vegetables, my wife raises our kids. We need to try to figure out how to make sure that everything we're doing on the farm is making return for the investment. So, do you want to talk about bricks and connectivity?
Can I have that one? It's a little longer. Okay. Can I just turn this off? Sometimes you have to do something fancy. Okay. So we've got about 20 minutes before lunch. I wanted to talk in very short about in-season plant monitoring. There are some very simple techniques that you can utilize to get a proactive understanding of what's going on in the plant. Generally, we wait until we see symptomology before we address issues. Yes? You don't do anything until things look bad? Some people hopefully are getting more proactive, but in general, we're more, you know, when you got 35 different crops you're managing, if they aren't sick, maybe they're not growing as fast as you'd like them to, you don't really go about doing anything proactively to solve problems until you see problems show up. That may not be the case for everyone, but in general, I don't think we have a really good proactive monitoring model in many cases that helps us see what's going on in the plants before they get sick and identify deficiencies before they turn into symptomology. If you see discoloration, your plant has already lost potential. Right, it has had an imbalance for a long enough time that it's starting to show up in a, you know, physiological deformity functionally, and that only happens after you've had imbalance for some time, and all these basic management processes that we're laying out here are really good strategies for preventing that kind of stuff from happening in a proactive fashion. But I find it's very helpful to have some basic tools to use for monitoring in season as well. So I'm just going to review two basic tools here. The conductivity meter is the first one. This is my conductivity meter. It's a very simple tool. It basically tells you what is the electrical current flowing in the soil right now. We know we all have electrical systems in our bodies. You know, all living systems are electrical. They have a functional current running in them at all points in time. The issue with the soil, and you know, basically minerals and compounds that are soluble or available, you know, oftentimes will have a charge, a functional charge. You know, and what a conductivity meter can do is measure the amount of charge in the soil. So the more charge you have, the more functional nutrient availability you have. The less charge you have, the less nutrient availability you have. Does that make some kind of basic sense to people? On a kind of intuitive sense? Soluble or available. A lot of the compounds that the microbial exudates, microbial, you know, what's the word? Metabolites, thank you. A lot of those metabolites are not simple ions, but they functionally have a charge like a soluble soluble anion would, or ion would. So I'm just gonna, a very simple sort of rules of thumb. My experience has been, you know, April, certainly March, April and into May even. You know, if you just prepare your soil as in, you know, prepare the seed bed and don't see about getting the energy going in the soil. Excuse me. Is there a glass of water somewhere? Thanks. You have generally between 30 and 50, you know, coming out on this as a number. And I generally say that 150 is a nice baseline to be aiming for. So there's millisiemens and there's microsiemens are the actual formal you know, numbers that you're looking for. And there's basically different meters are calibrated to either millisiemen or microsiemen. The one I have comes out in tens and hundreds, and other ones will come out in decimal points, 0.01 or 0.1 or 0.12. So in this case, 30 or 50 would be 0.03 or 0.05. So I'm looking for 150 on this meter, which on another meter would be 0.15. But they're the same number, they're just different the decimal points in different spot. So generally, a good crop fertilizer or a good cover crop breakdown will, by themselves, bring that conductivity level up. But for me, a baseline of 150 is a nice, solid rule of thumb. If your soil, you know, solution is at 150, when you put that seed in or you put that seedling in, you have a very good level of confidence that you're getting, that there's sufficient mineral availability for that plant to start growing right now. In many cases, when we put our plants in the ground in the spring, we plant our seeds, they take a long time to get established. They sit there for 2 or 3 weeks. They take a long time to germinate. When you have that kind of a situation, then that's when the weeds start to take over, etc., or the insects come in and start eating them. And being able to monitor conductivity and see where it's at really, you know, can predict for you very much whether that plant's going to be growing or sitting still. Basically makes sense? For starters, yes. Too high is certainly a bad thing. Yeah, you can fry the circuitry. You can fry it, and you can have a brownout. Usually, the issue with organic type people is we have a brownout. We have a more of a draw for nutrition or energy than we have sufficient, and lights start flickering, and you know the system shuts down. So, my experience generally is that brownout is the issue we need to be struggling with. 150 is, you know, a good target. 250 is plenty. Above 800 is where you're like, you know, 1,000 is too much. And that, you know, that can be a, you know, a way to tell whether you're putting enough of your, you know, inoculants on, or whether your, you know, fertilizer is working, or whether the cover crops are digesting well. You can use it for some people like numbers, some people like meters. Anybody here a spreadsheet person? There's a few spreadsheet people, and you know, some people work that way. They want a tool, they want a number, they want a graph. And if you're that kind of person, this is a very valuable tool. I happen to not be one of those people, but I know a lot of people are. So in generally, I recommend, you know, go out there every week, say Tuesday morning at 7, and take a tour and hit every crop. It's really simple. You push the button, you stick it in the soil, and a reading pops up. Nice digital readout. Very simple. You can do it rapidly. And if you do that week after week, and you write down your numbers, you can see 2 weeks ago we were at 150, last week we were at 160, and this week we're at 180. Great. Awesome. Your biological system is functioning, you're releasing more energy. You would like to have, you know, 600 or 400 when the tomatoes are filling fruit, when they're, you know, pregnant with octuplets, right? When that tomato plant is very hungry, you'd like to have that soil system releasing lots of mineral nutrition to feed it. And you can monitor that with a conductivity meter. So, and if you see it plateau or begin to drop off, that's a very good sign that you should expect the plants to stop growing. You should expect diseases to show up. You should expect insects to show up. You will see the movement in the conductivity before you see the symptomology in the plant. So it's a very good proactive tool. Yes? No. A correlation between conductivity meeting and CEC, cation exchange capacity, I don't think so. If your soil's too dry, you won't get a reading. If your soil's too dry, it's too dry. You need to get water into your soil. Yes? We talked about that before. Yes, if you don't get a reading because your soil's too dry, that's a good way to know that you need to do something about solving that solution, that issue. And just getting your meter in the ground to figure that out, maybe the first time you actually got your hands in the ground to notice that. So this is an excuse to get out there and check out each crop for, you know, 30 seconds or 2 minutes every week, which a lot of people think they should do, know they should do, and don't end up doing. Yes? Mm-hmm.
If you have hard water, is that going to change the reading? Theoretically, it should change the reading. I think it would have to be a lot of water to have that be a significant effect in the soil colloid. Yes. Absolutely.
So a lot of times what happens is people are seeing manifestation that actually comes from super sufficiency of salt ions and then in fertilizer.
This is in greenhouse media, in potting soil you're talking about, in composts.
Yeah, greenhouse beds.
Yeah, absolutely.
Productivity is that it's measuring salt ions, but it's not telling which ones.
Absolutely. It's measuring ions of all sorts. It's not discerning between any of them.
Sometimes it's then off to go the next step and go to measure.
If you've got the fancy techniques or the money to do lab tests, that certainly is superior. However, as far as a general guideline, are we generally low? Are we generally decent? Are we going up? Are we going down? Buy it once, buy new batteries every now and then, and you can really get a lot of data out of this. But it's very true. This is not giving you specific details on what exactly is available. It's giving you a general ballpark of what's available. Yes, very useful.
I just want to follow up on the greenhouse thing because I think it's a problem a lot.
Yes.
So what's the best thing once you find you have an elevated conductivity in your greenhouse, what's the best thing to do?
Elevated conductivity in hoop houses, greenhouses, areas where it doesn't rain, generally your salts will build up, whether it's sulfur or whatever the ions are. That's definitely a major issue for people who have hoop houses and are growing in the soil year after year after year. The simplest thing for me is on a regular basis, as in every 3 or 4 years when you're replacing the plastic, take it off in the spring and put it back in the fall. And that's a really good systemic management process. I think if you, are dealing with it right now, I think that the humicarb or any kind of a humic material, humates are very, very high exchange capacity. You can put them in very small quantities and into the water line, and they will bind up a lot of those salts. They won't remove them, but they'll functionally lower the conductivity and minimize their solubility. Yes.
The other thing is, if your sodium levels have built up in the greenhouse, you can kind of just pretend you're out west, where they basically put a heavy application of gypsum, followed up by a lot of water to flush some of that through with the sulfur. But you got to have the water to go through. You can't just say, put some gypsum on and it's done. So if you're noticing that on a soil test, application in the greenhouse, you might be putting on 1,000 to 2,000 pounds per acre of gypsum just to try and flush some of that out.
And basically, the issue in greenhouses or hoop houses is why this happens. Is because you water enough to keep the soil moist, but you never water enough to wash things through into the subsoil. And when you cover the plastic, you cover that area, you never get a 2-inch soaking rain that washes things through. So if you've got a water source that's not the problem, and you want to just soak the greenhouse, that's another thing to do. But I think the humates are a really good, cheap thing to do systemically, and taking the plastic off every 3 or 4 years also. Yes.
So on a practical level, since this isn't measuring specific ions, you go out and you find a low level.
Yes.
And you don't wait to do a soil test.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do?
On a practical level, this is very good. What do you do systemically if you've got low nutrition, low conductivity? That's when you consider feeding your plants again. From my perspective, systemically, what is feeding this conductivity system is sugar and photosynthesis. John made a big deal about photosynthesis last year. I hope we could spend more time this afternoon talking about it. The more well the plant is photosynthesizing, the more sugar it's manufacturing, the more food it's injecting into the soil. The more soil life are active, the more soil life are solubilizing minerals and digesting them and feeding them to the plant, and the higher the conductivity is. So functionally, especially early in the plant's life, you've transplanted in, and John was talking about, a three, four, five week period when it's sort of sitting there, it's growing slowly, and then it starts to grow really rapidly. During that period, when it's not growing fast, it's not big, a low conductivity
will basically tell you that your plant is not building a nice, strong root system. It's functioning at a low level of vitality. And the way to correlate that is a nice segue into the next topic, which is the refractometer. And this is what you do to check with refractometer readings in the plant. Does anybody have a fruit or an apple or an orange or a leaf, carrot? Yes, okay, great. I got one over here in the front row, second row. Orange is perfect. Can I have just a piece of orange? Yes. You can just peel it. Yeah, chuck a carrot up here. Go for it while we're. How many readings would I take? One low reading means take immediate action. I was going to use the carrot. That's fine. A low reading means it has less energy now. And so you can wait till tomorrow and check, but it's probably, if you had high energy last week and you got low energy now, there's probably a continuum. And what's exciting is you can identify it and engage in a very proactive fashion. You know, a week or two before you otherwise might have done something, you have the information that something needs to be done. And, most people have, good intentions and, get overextended and overwhelmed. So, it may take you a few years to get everything functioning, but at least this is a tool in the toolbox you can use to begin to move that process forward. Yes?
In addition to proper hydration has a big effect on conductivity reading. Temperature would also. So if you stuck that in a cold soil in the springtime, you'd get a low reading because there's not that
in a cold soil in the springtime, where there's no life above ground, there's no sugar being manufactured, there's no sugar being fed into the soil, there's no soil life being fed, there's no soil life solubilizing minerals, there's no conductivity. Which is why it's really, really helpful to keep your cover crops growing in the spring, if at all possible, because when you put your plants in after your cover crops, as long as they're growing, they are doing that process of feeding the soil life, which is facilitating mineral availability, which is really how plants are designed to eat. It is an issue in most places in the spring. Around here, we have low conductivity, and when you put your plants in there and they sit, you need to do something about it, or else they're just going to get eaten or diseased. Quickly, what's that? 3 minutes. Oh, hurrying up here with my refractometer. So, this carrot here is a carrot, or it's a tomato leaf, or it's a tomato, or it's a cucumber. This is anything, and you stick it in this little press or a garlic press, whatever you want to do. For this purposes of our conversation here, it's a leaf. It's a carrot leaf, it's a cucumber leaf, it's a tomato leaf, it's an apple leaf. And what we're doing is taking a drop off that leaf, we're squishing it, getting a drop out of it, and that's it. You look and you get a number. So here we've got 11. And you can do that on all your leaves in that much time. You take off a leaf, pass it around if you want to look at it. You know what it looks like. So you can go through and see what is the Brix reading of your plants as they're growing. And 12 is where you want to be. And if anybody is suffering from hubris, this is a wonderful cure. 12 is your target, and it's your target. And if you get there right now, then you won't have any improvement to do for the next 10 years. So if you're at 4 and you go to 6, congratulations. Aim for 7.
Dehydration of the
leaf. And Brix, again, is one number, which is, caused by a number of factors. And so a certain amount of common sense and practicality has to be applied. As Derek said, you take that tomato leaf in a hot summer day and you pick it and you leave it out on the picnic table for 5 minutes. And then you get and then you squish it. It's going to have less water in it and you're going to get a higher reading. Right? That's cheating.
That's not, this is a really good tool if you're being intellectually honest, and it's not sufficient for any kind of market purposes in most cases because it can be manipulated. But the combination of the refractometer reading and the conductivity reading is a really good way to proactively monitor your crops after you put them in the ground, as they start to grow, and you can check it every week and see who's doing well and who's not. And you can give a little extra attention and love to the ones who are not. So there was a question back here about now what do you do if you got low conductivity. Early in that life cycle period, this is when those foliar sprays are going to be really valuable. Derek had some enzymes and some inoculants that he was putting in the drench, the planting transplanting drench. I would put some inoculants, some soil inoculants, some maybe some kelp or some molasses, kelp and molasses, and some enzymes. I would re-inoculate the soil life with a drench. That would be a systemic thing to do. I would apply a foliar spray with a nice spectrum of trace elements, because in many cases it's those trace elements that are necessary to facilitate that whole photosynthetic process. So those are a couple of systemic things you can do to kickstart that process. And certainly, a general fertility, application is going to be beneficial. But the real objective is to stimulate the biological system to release from the soil everything that is there. And this is a way to see whether it's happening or not. Yes? Yes. Sometimes it's a very clear line, and sometimes it's a very wavy or indefined line. So in this case with that carrot, it was a very clear line. It was very specific, very clear. If it's passing around, people can look at it. It was an 11. Generally, the less distinct the line, the better. A clear line means, simple compounds, smaller compounds. The wavy line means larger compounds, which are diffracting the light more. They're compounds that basically with larger, with more facets, and so they're refracting the light through a larger lens. So, in general, if it's somewhere between 10 and 12, but you can't tell where, that's better than a very specific 11. Regardless of whether it was dried out or not, it would have been better if it was indistinct than as distinct as it was. Technical. My tongue. Tongue first and then genes. That's what the genes are for. I usually wear shorts in this summertime, but yeah. Nothing too fancy. Sorry. 12 is a target for leaves. And the fruits vary. So, there is a Brix chart in the handout which has all the target poor, average, good, excellent. This is a Reams chart. If you want to know where the data, the formal science behind this, it doesn't exist. This is all just people over time putting together something that seems about right. So this is everything with on the Reams side of things is much less well documented and cited, etc. Doesn't make it less true. But, if you want that kind of empirical data, it's hard to find. So the target is 12 on the leaf, and that means when you get that, you're going to have a large amount of sugar being manufactured, which is the foodstuff for the whole biological system, which is going to correlate with a nice root development, with a nice, biological activity in the soil, with good, vigorous growth, with nice color, rapid expansion in a balanced form. That's what's going to be the correlative effects. So when you start monitoring and you see you're at a 4 and you figure out what you need to do to get to a 5, congratulations. And see if you can go now to a 6. And that's, that's the work that you can do early in the season that will really pay off nicely down the road. And some of those, basic foliar sprays can be very valuable. But we'll talk a lot more about all that monitoring and process by crop after lunch. So we good? You want to give us the goodies? All right, yes. 12:30, I think we got to come back at 1:30?
I don't know.
Yes.
Sure, yes. Hi.
Coming back at 1:30.
Thank you. I know you had a long day of talking, so I'm just going to make this brief. But I wanted to take a second. I'm not so great in words, but I wanted to take a second to acknowledge all of you who brought all this amazing produce and preserves and sauerkraut and homemade bread and beans and barley and quinoa and so many things that you all grew and took the time to wash and bring here so that we could cook them. And it's just like, it's a vision of mine to be able to not only cook awesome food, but to be able to feed it back to the people who grew it with such an intention. And so what we've been trying to do down there is, you know, continue to keep that intention. We bought very little packaged food, and we soaked all the grains and the roots and just tried to put our love into them. So we have a really great crew down there. I want to acknowledge them. I was trying to get Delila to come up here, my assistant who went to go pick up one of her three sons. And I couldn't have done it without her. And also Joshua came to help today. And there's all the people. I have Doug and Bobby and Dan and Bob and Pam and Lee who helped me like consistently every day make this happen. So I really want to put a lot of acknowledgement out there for them. And they're all still down there working. and just say that I think this is something really powerful that we're doing here. That we're not only learning this here, but we're also, you know, feeding our bodies with it, and we're able to actualize that in a way. Like, how many conferences can you go to and eat your own food? You know, how many places can you go and eat good food during a workshop like this? So it's like, if you were to come here and you go home and you grow all this food, what's the point of it if you can't actually share it together in community? So this is something really, really powerful, and I want to acknowledge that. And just something that I don't know what you've been doing up here all day. I don't know your energy, but to transition into eating, like for me, the food is putting the food in our body is a really sacred thing. And it's kind of funny because I come up here to announce the food, but really what I want to do is just take a minute to transition into that. You know, so having any way that we can to experience that full with that food with our whole body. So if we can just take a second to just like, to transition and to really take that time to let this knowledge go into our body in multiple levels. So just take a second to just go in and breathe and be quiet. And I'll tell you what that food is down there waiting for you. And if you could give me just one moment to take it out of the oven before that help that so anxiously loves to come in, just you can ease your way in so that I can prepare for you. It's great to cook for farmers. You guys are great, great, great help. Every single one of you helps so much to prepare and to clean. So thank you. Let's do a clap for you too. So for the table, I don't know if some of you are here who weren't here yesterday, there's a table that's set aside for people who made special requests for their food, for vegetarian, dairy-free, gluten-free, and that's perpendicular to the breakfast serving table. And on that is a beautiful coleslaw that was brought, a non-dairy corn chowder, roasted cabbage, and veggies, and a salad, which is also the salad that's on the other table, but it's not dressed. There'll be a dressing next to it. And there's quinoa and stir-fry greens and beans and rice. And I'd prefer that goes to the people who need that first, and if there's extra, which there probably will be, then other people can, especially those people who were notified that there might not be enough food. I think today there'll be enough food, but if the people who were not registered for meals could wait until the end. And then anyone who's not registered for meals, who's been eating, if you can just check in with me so I know that you've been eating and we can count that. And the other food is there's brisket with Brussels sprouts and broccoli, there's roasted squash, and the squash is roasted in the bear lard. There's salad with shredded carrots, and it has a roasted garlic and currant dressing, and the currants from one of the jams that was here. And there's soaked quinoa, which is also cooked. There's black beans with spices, and then there's also a smoothie with yogurt for dessert. So, enjoy.
Thanks, Mira, for all your hard work. We're going to be back at 1:45 with John, Dan, and Derek. So see you then.